From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Many New Hampshire farmers ended up having a good year in 2020 as the pandemic spurred greater interest in local food. That's not to say it was easy. As in every sector, those who work in agriculture had to change overnight and struggle to adapt their businesses to new realities. But now it's spring, a year later, and New Hampshire farmers say they've learned a lot and that some of the changes they made out of necessity, they'll stick with, even in better times. Today in The Exchange, Granite State farmers look ahead at the upcoming season. And Exchange listeners, let's hear from you. If you work in agriculture, how did last year go for you? If you connect with local farmers as a customer, how did that connection change? Our email is exchange@nhpr.org, and our phone number is 800-892-6477. Our guests are Andre Cantelmo, co-owner of Heron Pond Farm in Southampton, president of the New Hampshire Vegetable and Berry Growers Association, and a co-founder of Three River Farmers Alliance, a farmer-owned food hub on the seacoast. Andre, welcome. It's great to have you.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Also with us, Kate Osgood, owner of Birch Rise Farm in Sanbornton, selling pasture-raised chicken, pork, and turkey. She's treasurer of the Belknap County Farm Bureau Board and an advisor to UNH Extension. Kate, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And our third guest is Robert Johnson, Policy Director for the New Hampshire Farm Bureau Federation and owner of Johnson Bros Farm in Pittsfield, where he raises cattle and offers maple sugar and pick-your-own blueberries. And Robert, great to have you too. Welcome.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, Andre, let's start with you. Overall, how did your farm do last year?
We saw, tremendous increase in demand for, local food. And luckily, we were able to step up to the plate. The marketing that we did was changed. Farmers markets were, way down. And it was more, the farm store and then the direct-to-consumer through Three River Farmers Alliance that we saw demand really spike. And then the CSA. The CSA memberships all across New Hampshire seem to have been really robust. And then this spring, we're seeing that a lot of that is sticking to it. So people have tasted the food and the resource, and they seem to, those registration numbers seem to be, maintained this year as well.
Wow. So CSAs, community supported agriculture, for folks who might not know what that is, where, Andre, right, you buy a share in your local CSA, and farmers sort of aggregate their products, and then you go once a week and you pick it up, right?
Yeah, it's done a couple different ways that different farms have different models. But at Heron Pond Farm, it's a free choice CSA. So, there's groups of items on a board, and, you kind of build your share as you go. Some have six shares that are like pre-boxed and ready to pick up, and you pick up those things. So farms have taken the CSA model and really stretched it to adapt to, whatever they feel that their local clientele are really asking them for. So farms have been very adaptive that way.
So Robert, of course, each farm is unique, but what's the big picture that you saw emerging for local farms from last year?
Generally good, ranging from excellent in some sectors to getting by. But there, as I think you mentioned earlier, there are concerns and issues, with increased cost, availability of labor, the concern with moisture coming out of a droughty year and in a dry spring. And then I guess the big question is also looking ahead as will consumers, purchasing habits continue as they have.
Wow. It's interesting to hear you use the word excellent. Very rarely do we hear that word associated with 2020. What was excellent, Robert?
Well, in the ornamental horticulture greenhouse sector.
Wow.
I've had growers tell me that, the demand is the highest it's ever been. Best year ever. Ramping up in anticipation of the continuing year.
So that's sort of people planting bushes and flowers and so forth? Is that what that
Correct.
Is?
Correct. Correct.
Yeah.
The ornamental sector for flowers and landscaping and things like that. And, with people being home as they're buying, they're improving their homes and their yards.
Right. And they've got to buy those blueberry bushes from somebody. And we'll talk a little bit later in the show, definitely about those points you made, Robert, availability of labor and the drought. But Kate, how about you? What kind of a year did Birch Rise Farm have last year?
We had a very busy year where you wouldn't think with 2020 and a lot of the restrictions that were put on that we would have. Right. But our year was very busy. We opened the farm store up and we just were inundated with customers, which was great. We had a lot of customers who were interested in buying in bulk to they were concerned that there wouldn't be meat in grocery store for a while. So they would just come and, you know, fill their freezers or buy freezers and then buy a whole bunch of meat to fill those. So we were very, very busy.
Wow. And what did you hear from other farmers in your area, Kate, given that you also work on the Belknap County Farm Bureau?
Many of the livestock farmers actually said the same thing. We have quite a few that were selling beef and they are sold out until either May of this year or even fall of 2021 because they've taken so many pre-orders.
What is it, Kate, that is really sparking this interest in local meat? And I remember last spring, we talked to somebody in the North Country who ran a local meat store and same thing, just could not keep it on the shelves.
I would have to say a lot of people are more aware of what's in their food and they're wanting to make more healthier choices for them and their family. And I think that has really kind of helped, as well as I know here on our farm, we actually breed pigs. So people will come out and see the breeders and see the mom and dad and kind of see how we treat the animals. And they're very interested in buying an animal that is treated well as well.
Well, looking at all of what you experienced, all three of you last year, and I know you had to make a lot of changes to the way you conducted your operations. And Andre, you kind of hinted at, you know, big marketing and distribution changes for you and your partners. What were some of the changes that you made last spring that you're going to continue with? You made the change and you thought, wow, this kind of works.
Well, we had, through Three River Farmers Alliance, we have had since, 2014, a way to aggregate local food and distribute it in the wholesale side of the supply chain. About this time last year, pretty much every farmer's market, and we're a four-season farm. There are a lot of four-season farms out there now. It's become much more popular. And the farmer's markets just shut down, and we had no avenues for our product. So we took the model of the Three Rivers Farmers Alliance and decided to pivot it to a home delivery model because we had an aggregation site. We had access to all these different farms' food. And we were saying, let's just change the way that we aggregate food and distribute it. You know, some of the challenges there were the consumer, local consumers don't understand that, when they order something, it may, the milk might not even be out of the cow yet. And the spinach wasn't even harvested yet. Three River Farmers Alliance is an aggregator. So they order the food and the software tells the farmer that, hey, someone ordered your food. They harvest, prepare the food, bring it to Three River, and Three River uses its, distribution arm to make sure that we connect the food to the consumer. So local consumers, the direct-to-consumer and home delivery model was a little challenging to communicate that at first, but now that people are starting to catch on to the fact that, I'm ordering this and it's the freshest it could be, we see potential for this to go on beyond, the year of the pandemic. And we have invested in the infrastructure to continue this going forward. And we've gone from 40 farms that we aggregate with up to 80 farms that we, aggregate with to be able to supply that many people with local food that they want.
Wow, that's quite an operation, Andre. 80 farms and delivering, home by home by home. That sounds large and time consuming to go to that many homes.
It would be if we didn't have an amazing team that and a really good system. And so we're really software dependent, and that really helps. And then you know, the team gets the food, you know, all the partner farms bring in their food to one central location. And, you know, you could have ordered food from 12 different farms, but it all ends up in your box.
Wow.
And then on the right truck going into the right area. And so, yeah, I stand back in amazement that this stuff happens. but it does happen really well. And, you know, the mistakes that we made in the beginning really helped us to be able to come up with corrective measures that make it run much smoother now. So, yeah, it's a pretty incredible system.
Robert, how do food hubs like Three River that Andre is describing, how are these food hubs sort of changing the business model for New Hampshire agriculture, for these mostly small farms that we have in our state?
Well, I'd say that they're expanding on the direct sales that already exist, you know, from not just the consumer coming to the farm, but the farmer going to the consumer. I would say that's the big one. Much of what Andre and the Alliance are doing.
Have you heard about other food hubs around the state, Robert?
There are a few others, not to the degree of the Three Rivers Alliance, to my understanding.
Kate, how about you? How did you sort of change your business model in ways large or small last year? And which of those changes do you plan to stick with this year?
Sure. We actually started a CSA program as well here. We are primarily meat, so it was based just on that. We did a third of each, pork, chicken, and then we partnered with another farm and did beef. And so there were three different sizes of meat bundles that they could buy. They could do a piglet package, a sow package, or a boar package, and it was a different amount of weight. Piglet was 25 pounds, sow was 40 pounds, and then a boar was 70 pounds of meat. And then they would come to the farm, pick it up once a month, and have meat for their family. And that really was very popular and something we'll be continuing again.
Did you do, Kate, the sort of experiential farm offering? You know, this is pre-pandemic, obviously, where people come to the farm and, you know, they walk around. Maybe there's a little tractor ride or something. Maybe the kids can pet, you know, goats or whatever you have. Did you used to do that sort of experience, Kate?
We did, actually. Something that we've done every year since we've started was the Great Pumpkin Dump after Halloween, where we have kids come in their costumes and they bring their pumpkins that they've carved and they feed them to the pigs or the sheep or the chickens or turkeys. And just the kids just loved it. We had one this year, obviously with COVID guidelines, but it was not a great turnout. We didn't have as many people as we had hoped or had in previous years. And our ideas of wanting to do, you know, movie on the farm and different things like that just weren't able to happen. We did, however, we have potbelly pigs that people love to visit. And those really helped when the lines were getting long. The pigs would go up and down the line and greet everybody. And so that actually made it so that people weren't very aggravated when they had to stand in line 6 feet apart because we only allow two people in the farm store at a time.
Did people get aggravated about that? Only two people in the farm store at a time? Yeah.
Yeah. In the beginning, before the governor had put the mask mandate on, there was some people that got frustrated, just different people of different views. And some people would get a little frustrated with it, but we were able to alleviate that by giving farm tours and the potbelly pigs. And my children love to show their chickens. So we were able to defuse the situation, but the governor mandate of masks and such really helped.
I want to remind listeners that we are talking with three New Hampshire farmers today about what they learned from last year and how they're hoping to apply it to this year. And let's hear from you, your questions or personal experiences with local farming and your hopes for the new season. Send us an email. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or call 800-892-6477. So, Robert, in addition to your role with the New Hampshire Farm Bureau Federation, you have a pick-your-own blueberry operation, and I wonder what changes you had to make to that last year.
Essentially none. It's a very small operation, about an acre, and it's something we're developing for the future. And this past year we didn't have open hours. It was called by appointment, so we could regulate the activity down there.
Oh, I see. So pick your own by appointment. That kind of makes sense anyway, right, Robert? So a whole mess of people don't come one day and pick you out?
Yes, it's very helpful, and it allows us to spread things out and do things that way.
And Kate talked, Rob, about, just really the heavy, heavy demand for local meat. And I've heard that from other farmers. What's the sort of big picture in terms of local meat here in New Hampshire? I have heard in the past, for example, that some farmers like Kate have a hard time finding places to process the meat.
Yeah, that's certainly it's a huge challenge. And there are a number of reasons for it. And in state, we currently only have four facilities that are USDA, provide USDA processing, which allows for meat to be sold over state, across state lines. And they're challenged with labor. The processing facilities, just like our farms are, is a real challenge.
Yeah. And in terms of the berries, I need to bring you in, Andre, because again, you're president of the Vegetable and Berry Growers Association here in the state. Any changes to pick your own operations that in the end might be good changes?
I think that, as Robert pointed out, having, people spaced out more really helped a lot of the operations. One of the things that was good this year about UPIC is that it is an outdoor activity that you can socially distance, and people being so desperate just to kind of do something outside of their home, outside of their local area, their wheelhouse, just to kind of get the family out a little bit, that seemed to be a big help. There were some yield problems with a lot of the drought stress that we did have this year that was reported, to our organization from across the state. But on the other side, it also kind of reduced some pest problems. So, the weather giveth and the weather taketh away. The other thing about not having so many rain days is that, people don't like to come out and pick their own in the rain. So that it can be helpful there if you're set up with good irrigation.
Andre, you're giving me the perfect segue to take a quick break, and then let's talk more about the drought when we come back, because I know that is a big, big issue for all of you coming up. So we'll talk about the drought. We'll also touch on, again, finding workers on New Hampshire farms, and we'll start taking your questions. So give us a call at 800-892-6477 or email exchange at nhpr.org, and we'll be right back. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, Granite State farmers on what they learned this past year and how they're planning for the new season. What questions or experiences do you have with local farming? How do you think the pandemic has changed agriculture in our state? We'd love to hear from you. Send us an email. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or call 800-892-6477. We're talking with three farmers, Andre Cantelmo of Heron Pond Farm in Southampton, Kate Osgood of Birch Rise Farm in Sanbornton, and Rob Johnson, Policy Director for the New Hampshire Farm Bureau Federation and owner of Johnson Bros Farm in Pittsfield. One more time, that number, 800-892-6477. And all of you, let's go right to our listeners. And Jameson's calling from Manchester. Hi, Jameson, you're on The Exchange. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Sure.
I wanted to call in and really give a shout out to the Sustainability Institute at UNH and the New Hampshire Food Hub Network. And the Kearsarge Food Hub recently got a federal grant to be able to do all this really extensive planning and mapping around how food is moving around the state. And you know, it really shows how resilient the food system is in New Hampshire, especially in these past few, well, this past year.
Yeah, it sounds
so
like this
really
is...
wanted to.
Yeah, Jameson, I want to ask you a question, actually. Sounds like you have involvement in this field. So are you a farmer yourself, or are you helping organize a local food hub?
Yeah, so I work for ORIS, the Organization for Refugee and Immigrant Success, and we have a food hub we just developed in Manchester. And so we've been working closely with Jessica Gorin and Kearsarge Food Hub, really around trying to connect food into the city, especially on these shoulder seasons when, you know, there's very little around. So it takes quite a bit of networking and planning and logistics. And without that support and that group, we wouldn't be able to be where we are now.
Oh, that's interesting. So I have read about the Organization for Refugee and Immigrant Success. Am I saying it right, Jameson?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. So the farmers of this group, I'm assuming, are immigrants and refugees, and they're growing produce, and then they're able to sell it to the broader New Hampshire market? Is that how it works?
Yeah, exactly. There's 23 farmers, new American farmers, that we provide TA to, and then also marketing assistance. So we help in aggregating the produce and really doing home delivery and getting it out to direct to consumers. So it just helps with some barriers around language or lack of transportation. But they're, most of them were farmers back home, so it's really just about kind of adjusting their skill set to this climate and you know, the market here, and they take right off.
Wow. Where do the farmers in your group, Jameson, tend to be located? Is it Manchester, Concord, all over the state?
Yeah, there's 9 growers that are living in Manchester right now, and they grow at a farm that we own in Dumbarton. And then there's 14 growers that live in Concord, and they're growing on some leased land from the St. Paul's School. We're growing about 15 acres total.
I have walked by that land many times, Jameson, and had wondered what was happening there. So thank you very much for calling. Really interesting to hear from you.
Yeah, thanks.
All right. Again, our number is 800-892-6477. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. And here's an email from Denise that I want to share with all of you. Denise says, I love the idea of supporting local food, but it's become so expensive, I can hardly do so. I recently paid $7 for a dozen eggs and $14 for 3 smallish delicata squash, as an example. I hope I'm pronouncing that right, Denise. Unfortunately, that means, she says, I go to the big chain supermarkets. We're all struggling in this economy, not just farmers. Denise, I'm glad you wrote, because this is something I wanted to address. It is something we hear a lot from listeners. And Robert, to you first, how do local farmers sort of work with this price competition from the big providers at the big grocery stores?
It's certainly a challenge. I think they point out to the, you know, stress, the freshness and the local benefits of what they're producing. But it is a challenge.
What are ways to get around that challenge? I'm not suggesting, you know, people immediately drop their prices, but are there creative ways that you've seen to get around it?
Not that I'm thinking of immediately.
Yeah. I don't mean to put you on the spot there, Rob. Go ahead, Andre.
Yeah. What we're finding with the Three River Farmers Alliance is, like, the aggregation is starting to address this to a certain extent, where you have small farmers being able to maybe specialize in certain crops and be able to drop their prices. We've seen this, like, probably most dramatically in the greens market lately, because if you're specializing in greens and you can invest in the proper washing and harvesting equipment, then your cost of production is going to go down. And so what we've had in the state, because Robert was pointing out that, like, it's been a real direct to consumer market for a very long time. And we would all, like, feel like we had to grow everything and show up to farmers market and have a full pallet of everything that you would possibly need. And please stop at my farm stand instead of the guys next to us and get what you need. And with a more, you know, diverse marketplace, we can start to maybe specialize in a couple of different foods. And for instance, like, Heron Pond Farm has invested in, like, a bean picker. And so instead of having to have, you know, the labor, you know, to pick beans, like other small farms may be able to sell Heron Pond Farm beans at their stand at a reasonable price instead of having to pay hourly labor to go hand pick beans or something like that. And that's just one example of how, you know, aggregation can start to help drive those things. And that's why I think that, you know, our director of operations at Three River is trying to like get more people, you know, more local food, because we're finding that like by these aggregation methods, like there are institutions and larger facilities that are interested in having local food at a reasonable price, that if we can meet those price points, then we're even increasing the demand for local food even more. So we're kind of using the consumer demand to drive a system that can bootstrap economy of scale to be able to supply institutions and other places so that we can move even more volume of local food at reasonable prices.
That's interesting. So banding together and also greater use of technology. You described the software earlier, Andre, that you guys use to sort of aggregate everything and distribute it. That could help on the cost. I'd like your thoughts too, Kate, on this. You know, again, both as a small provider yourself, but also as someone who talks a lot to other local farmers in Belknap County.
Sure. I would just agree with Andre, definitely partnering up with a lot of different farms who specialize in other things. And then also, for example, I don't offer beef, but I'll offer it and partner with a farm to offer beef for my customers here. Another way, there's different ways that farmers can kind of cut the cost or change the cost in ways if you're buying in bulk feed opposed to just single bag feed, that there's a different price there, which in the end changes the price of the product. And then labor is a big thing as well. But that is definitely a question we get a lot, but we find that people really respond to the taste, the different tastes that they see, how healthy the animals are, that they get to meet the animals. And that is a bigger deterrent than just the price point. Actually, knowing what's in their food.
Yeah. And that's valuable too to consumers. And to this point again, Denise, thank you very much for writing, because it's something that comes up a lot. Joseph from Manchester also wrote, he says, I wish either the local or even the federal government would encourage local food and local farming more. Joseph says, well, I love being able to eat, quote, fresh oranges during January. The transportation and encouragement of industrial farming practices is horrible for our environment, Joseph says, versus these local farms, which are usually run by local families. Joseph, thank you for writing. Talking about the costs, I know one of the costs that some farmers struggled with last year was the drought. And Rob, I wanted to ask you about that. If a global pandemic weren't bad enough, farmers in New Hampshire did face a severe drought last year. What was the scope of the impact, Rob?
Well, it was statewide. We're still feeling it. That's one of the current concerns that particularly on the livestock end, farmers have is that, you know, they're entering a last couple months of the, you know, you could say the winter season when there's not fresh feed available and they're needing to make purchases. And there's a lot of concern moving forward as we've had a dry spring. You know, currently there's pockets of the upper valley, they're in a moderate drought, you know, according to the National Drought Monitor. And if we're in a moderate drought now, you know, we're what does that mean as we get into our drier season coming up in a few months?
So that's interesting. So explain that to me a little bit more, Robert. So in addition to the drought we had last year, so far the forecast or what we have seen so far isn't great?
Well, you're currently, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association, they put out a National Drought Monitor, and it's they classify droughts by, there's a D1, D2, 3, and 4, with a D1 being moderate to D2 severe, 3 is extreme, and 4 is exceptional. And then there's a I guess you'd say kind of a waiting area, whereas in which is below a D1, which is abnormally dry. Well, currently, the entire southern part of the state is classified as abnormally dry, with those pockets in the upper valley that are on a D1. So yes, as much as they can, not that they're projecting ahead, but that's where we are currently. And just knowing, from past experience that our dry months are you get into July and August. So there's a concern out there, especially on the livestock side. Currently, feed supplies are low, and they're needing to bring in feed from other areas of the region. So it's certainly been on farmers' minds, all of them, and not just livestock, but I'm sure it's on Andre's mind as well.
Well, sure. So let's talk about that, Kate. You raise animals. Not being a farmer, I immediately understand the impact of drought on plants, but I hadn't thought so much about the impact on animals. So go ahead, Kate, please tell us how that affected you.
Sure. So a pig can actually consume about 6 gallons of water a day, between 3 and 6 gallons. So thinking that, at one point I had 57 meat pigs on my farm, that's a lot of water. So last year we did everything we could do to conserve water. We put up rain barrels. We conserved our own personal use, limited things that we were doing, really made sure that we could do everything that we could to conserve water, because we were worried that our well would go dry. But that is a big concern for us as well this year with everything going on. And we're probably going to have to put up the rain barrels again and really just try to collect as much water as possible on top of what's already in our well.
Wow. And in addition to, as you said, last year and then looking ahead, Rob told us so far it's not great in terms of drought, but we'll hope for the best. How about you, Andre? How did you approach this lack of moisture and sort of adapt your growing practices to make the best of it, at least?
I don't know how you can adapt your growing practices too much, other than at one point, you just decide not to plant that thing because there's not going to be the water to take care of it. We saw at Heron Pond Farm, probably the worst potato year that we've had since I've been doing this. And that's something that, we had taken over for Valley Acres Farm, the Savinsky Farm. That was the farm that we transitioned from, and they were mainly a potato farm. So kind of potatoes are in the genes of this farm, and to see that crop kind of dwindle and not be able to size was, just heartbreaking. We kind of doled out water. The state has a bunch of programs that help you with guidance. So not only do we have irrigation grants coming out of NRCS or something like that, but they have guidance. And then also, I just want to, just give a shout out to Trevor Hardy down at Brookdale Fruit Farm for being a really great resource for irrigation specialists for the state. He's a farmer that sells irrigation equipment. And, we have a lot of micro emitters that really just put down just the amount of water that is necessary to kind of keep a crop going until you could get to a thunderstorm or rain that might size up your carrot crop or size up those beets or give the broccoli enough water to make it to another day. And that's kind of we were just swinging from one water vine to the other. But the challenges are, the moving the water is expensive, especially when you start shuttling water far from further afield. And then the other thing is that, every time you water something, we do have, I don't want to get into it. You could do a whole show on food safety. But every time you water something in the vegetable industry, then, there are food safety costs that come up because you have to log it all. You have to take care and monitor things. It's the landscape has changed in that area too.
So, oh, wow. I had no idea. You talked about some micro knitters. Did I hear you right there, Andre?
Yeah.
What is
that? I I only know the brand name, and I certainly don't work for this company, but Netafilm is the company that, that Trevor sells, and they have these, they are very small, emitters, that basically they water like regular sprinklers, but they do it in such a way that they use very low, you know, gallons per minute, and you get very good saturation, very little runoff, and you can really fine-tune the exact amount of water you're kind of spoon-feeding something. I hate to put it that way, but like sometimes...
Oh, that's a good way to put it, actually.
You know, it needs a lot more water than I'm going to give it, but I'm going to give it this much to keep it alive. Wow. And if you have a limited water source, like, you know, a holding pond, even if it was spring-fed and then the spring stopped feeding it, you see that pond going down and down, you're like, well, I'm giving this a quarter-inch, acre-inch of water. You know, an acre-inch of water, which everybody's like, oh, most crops need an inch of water a week or something. An inch of water is 27,000 gallons of water. That's an acre inch. And so that's a lot of water. And
that is a lot of water.
Yeah. And you need to, you know, sometimes just make decisions like this is the crop that we're keeping. And, you know,
and this is the one we're letting go.
Water to get by. Yeah.
Wow. Well, I want to remind listeners that you can join us with your questions and comments. It's been great to hear from you, whether you work in farming or you connect with your local farmers. Join us with your comments, questions, and some of the changes that you saw last year as New Hampshire agriculture adapted to the pandemic. Our phone number is 800-892-6477. And our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Katie wrote us, she says, I thought I might provide part of an answer as to why the boom in buying local meat. After seeing the horrifying videos and photographs of commercial meatpacking plants on the news every night, with people dying of COVID on the lines, Katie says, I stopped buying meat in stores altogether. I bought a share of a friend's pigs, and I'm eating a lot more local fish from the Daily Haul and occasionally splurge and buy local lamb when I can. Katie, thank you very much for writing. We also had an emailer who wanted to know about the group that came up earlier, ORIS, or ORIS. That's the Organization for Refugee and Immigrant Success, and it operates Fresh Start Farms in New Hampshire, a collective for new American farm enterprises. ORIS develops local market, trains local farmers. So Lynn had written wanting to know more about that. And there's some information for you, Lynn. Again, our number for you to join us is 800-892-6477. And our email is exchange@nhpr.org. I want to ask all of you about labor. And Kate, to you first, how easy or hard is it for you to find the workers you need to keep your farm running?
Well, honestly, we are family, 100% family run. So
we don't
hire any workers. what I do is I do team up with some of the ag programs in local high schools. And I have people who, students who need to do service hours to graduate. And so I have one gal who's coming from Franklin High School right now. And she puts in hours so that she can graduate. So she comes up and helps on the farm a bit. But another thing that we have done is we have teamed up with Belknap County Jail, and we have the inmates come and we teach them life skills and work on the farm. And that has been not only rewarding to us to kind of show them some life skills, but rewarding to them. We've had a few that have gotten out of jail and then immediately gone into different jobs where they say, you know, I really loved coming to the farm that day. It makes me want to get into agriculture. And so we actually will team up with them to have them come up and help us on the farm too.
That's really interesting. When did you get started with that, Kate, working with the Belknap County Jail?
So 2 years ago, I believe it was. And my husband grew up in the area and knew a few people. And I went in and I said, hey, well, you know what? Would they be interested in coming up and learning things on the farm? And we did, they worked with electrical and helped us put up fencing. And then we actually had them help us put up a frost-free hydrant, and we had somebody come in and show them plumbing and just different things that they could do on the farm that are different life skills. There was a lot of younger guys who came up. Early 20s was mainly the inmates that came up. So it was nice to show them, you know, you can always go back to school and you can learn a trade.
Wow. And I was going to ask all of you later anyway about, you know, the aging of the farm workforce and how to get young people perhaps interested in agriculture. So there you go. There's part of it. What's the outlook for farmers overall, Rob, for finding the workers that they're going to need? I'll just preface that by saying I drove past a farm in Hillsborough just over the weekend near Fox State Forest, and huge banners outside this farm, you know, colorful, waving in the breeze. You couldn't miss them. Now hiring. So what's the picture, Rob?
Well, it's the biggest concern I hear, Laura.
Really?
Yes. The availability and the cost. I think you're probably aware, there is a federal program, H-2A guest workers, and in New Hampshire, they're primarily from Jamaica, and it's an outstanding program, but it is costly. We have in a neighborhood of approaching 200 H-2A guest workers in New Hampshire. There are over about a quarter of a million nationwide, and it's growing. There's a federal wage rate that's set for these workers, and in New Hampshire and the Northeast and New York, it's $14.99 currently an hour, and that doesn't sound, you know, that's doesn't sound that bad. But then you add that the employer, the farmer, has to pay transportation back and forth, and all, you know, paperwork and that type of thing, and that amounts to about $1,500. And then they also house them and their transportation locally they're responsible for. But it does provide a highly skilled workforce. And many of these workers they're essentially family members. I was talking to a grower the other day, and he has seven H-2A workers coming this year. Four of them have been with him for 20 plus years.
Oh, wow.
They're part of his family. As a matter of fact, he's vacations in Jamaica occasionally to visit them and their families. So he was telling me, he says, if they show up and I'm not here, I have no doubts that they'll just, you know, they know what to do. I don't need to be there. So you've got that piece, but as far as those that don't have the resources for H-2A, finding workers is again, a huge challenge. I give you another example talking with a grower recently. He's located in the Greater Manchester area. And he had four of his workers leave him who had been with him for quite some time, but they left for better paying jobs elsewhere. And so he's been relying on a temp agency for some years. And last year, this temp agency was sourcing works for him for $15 an hour. And this was $15 that he's paying the agency. This year, he's got four workers coming later this week. And he's having to pay $27 an hour to get these workers. It's for his small operation, which is a family-run operation. He has no choice. And he's just going to have to take it day by day. But I hear it continuously. It's not only is it the challenge of workers, but it's also with the pandemic. As one greenhouse operator told me, it's one of these things that's it's just mentally draining. Concern for not just having whether the worker's going to be available, but for their health while on
right.
the job with everything
yeah.
going on.
Well, I was going to ask you about that, and I hear you speaking with, you know, such respect and appreciation for the guest workers, especially the Jamaican farm workers. So are there restrictions on their arrival, Rob, due to COVID?
Yes, there are. My understanding is they're currently being, the Jamaica workers in particular, you know, they're tested in Jamaica. They come here and then there's a quarantine period, there's some challenges to it because they, you know, farms have you know, the bunkhouses, their living facilities where they were, you know, set up for a certain number, and now because of quarantining and they need to be, has the correct spacing for the current conditions. That piece can be a challenge. When they're working, it's not as big a challenge. They're outside, you know, in the fields, and that can be handled. But
sure.
It is a new world when it comes to all that.
Yeah, and I hear you on the mentally draining part. We have to take a very quick break, but when we come back, Andre, I'll also ask about the labor situation for your farm and for your farm partners on the seacoast. And we'll keep taking your questions. You can join us with a phone call, 800-892-6477, or send us an email. It's exchange@nhpr.org. More with New Hampshire farmers in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, the Deputy Commissioner of New Hampshire Employment Security takes your questions about unemployment benefits and more. Join us for that conversation Thursday morning, live at 9. Today, we're checking in with New Hampshire farmers, what they learned last year, what they're hoping for this spring. And Exchange listeners, if you work in farming or you're just connected with the farms in your area, join us with your comments, experiences, questions. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Or give us a call, 800-892-6477. Our farmers are Andre Cantelmo, co-owner of Heron Pond Farm in Southampton, Kate Osgood, owner of Birch Rise Farm in Sanborton, and Robert Johnson, policy director for the New Hampshire Farm Bureau Federation and owner of Johnson Bros Farm in Pittsfield. And Andre, just before the break, we were talking about labor and, you know, Robert told us the huge struggles that Farm Bureau members have. Kay told us about reaching out to high school students, to people at the Belknap County Jail. What's the labor picture look like for you, Andre, and your partners?
Well, my business partner, Greg Balog at Heron Pond Farm, handles a lot of the, you know, the labor situations here. And one of the key things that he does is we kind of bring up what we call a JV crew, and they are high schoolers and maybe some early college kids that, you know, work for us from time to time and do very specific tasks that are, you know, kind of rote. They get into a program, they like kind of see, you know, the mechanisms of the farm. But the other thing that we're blessed with here, and it's quite possibly just by the networking and maybe people knowing what Heron Pond Farm is on the seacoast, is we have a lot of young, I call them young, they're adults, you know, adults, you know, post-college adults that really, they want to be farmers. And they, like, their goal is to have their own farm in the end. And they work here, and they have incredible leadership and a lot of responsibility and are put in charge and put in to manage certain crops or certain activities on the farm. And they get an overall education on, you know, crop planning and everything and all that while basically, you know, basically doing the farm. And by having that kind of worker that's invested in farming, they tend to really, you know, step up and do, you know, amazing work for us. And the hard part for us is that that's a revolving door. I mean, right. I think the longest that we've ever kept anybody is about 7 years, but they want to leave and go and do their own thing. We have challenges and, you know, and have never been able to adapt to the H-2-1A program because of, you know, some of the housing requirements and some of the other things that are going on in this farm. And I think that there are other challenges that are happening, too, that Rob alluded to, but that, you know, like a current posting that we all use is like Good Food Jobs. Like, we post our jobs to Good Food Jobs. Well, Good Food Jobs just decided that, like, it's not going to post anything, like, it's incrementally doing this, but it's like eventually if you don't have a job at $15 an hour, it won't be posted on their site. So, you know, getting the word out about the jobs that you have is going to become, you know, more difficult unless you're offering at least, you know, $15 an hour. And Heron Pond Farm is already under those pressures because, you know, we're, you know, a couple hundred yards from the Massachusetts border where there is, you know, a higher minimum state minimum wage. And so, like, just the area's marketplace, the pressures on, like, what you pay labor is going up. And so coming up with those on-farm efficiencies, being so reliant on, like, extension and, you know, some of the agricultural groups to be like, how can we be more efficient so that we can make the best of the labor that we can afford to have?
It kind of sounds like you are, in a way, doing like an internship or apprenticeships with some of the younger people who are interested in farming. Is that right, Andre?
I would hesitate to call it an internship. I mean, you know, Greg would Greg's better at it than I am. Greg will, like, you ask him a question, you know, we both come from, you know, we both have, you know, soil-based science degrees from, you know, Rutgers University. We're like really into like geeking out on the farming, you know, the farming end. And so you ask us a question and like it goes on probably longer than you wanted the answer for. But and I think the staff really appreciates that, but they're working and they're working really hard. Like internship, you know, I think like there is definitely a probably a more formal education component. I think if you work here and you are interested and you ask questions, you'll get all the answers that you want. And so in that way, it can be educational. But the folks here have proven themselves to be, you know, incredibly hard workers. And we've had just really great luck to have the like this kind of team to put together.
Yeah. Well, and this gets to a question I wanted to ask all of you. So, Kate, to you, the future of farming, bringing new farmers, younger farmers into the fold, what are some ideas that you have, Kate, around this, or what would you like to see happen?
Well, big thing is 4-H. And I know that they've announced that there will be a Belknap County Fair again this year. And I have young children who are active in 4-H and who will be active in Future Farmers of America, FFA, and then hopefully young farmers with Farm Bureau. But getting, showing people at fairs the animals and showing just getting people involved with animal husbandry is just huge in ours, in our minds, to really help interest people in farming in the future.
Well, I hadn't even thought about that. The cancellation of a lot of fairs doesn't help with those efforts, does it, Kate?
No, it did not last year.
Robert, what's your message to younger people, you know, thinking about a career in farming, but not sure? What would you say?
Explore it. Work on an operation, different types, ask questions. You know, one thing, Laura, I'd like to say is that, you know, I'm in my mid-50s, and when I was in school, farming wasn't cool with my classmates and generally with friends. And that's changed. I have two sons in their young 20s, and with them and with their buddies, and I see it because they have them over here, and they love agriculture. They love farming. It's cool. It's something they talk about and they're proud of it. So I think that's a good sign. The other thing I'd like to mention on this is you see the national statistics that show through the stats that our farming is aging. Well, maybe our landowners are aging, but because of just the cost of land, but our farmers, I don't quite ascribe to the data as it's showing. And I'll use the example of my farm. You know, like I said, I'm in my mid-50s, but my boys run a couple of the operations and they're in their young 20s, and their ages are not reflected in the data. So I think it's a little bit of an inaccuracy with some of what you see.
Oh, that's interesting. Yes. And the last time we did a show on farming, we had a dairy farmer on who also, he owns the farm, but he runs it with his sons. So that's a really good point, Rob. I'm glad you made that. And just to the popularity of local farming, as you said, Rob, John wrote us an email. John, I don't have time to read the whole thing, but I do want to share some of it. John says, when agritourism took root in our region, there were fewer than 2,000 farmers markets nationwide. Now the movement has grown. There are nearly 20,000 nationwide in less than 20 years. John says, local farms help us diversify markets in important ways and offer a vital connection to the food we eat and stewardship of our natural resources. He says, I also see farmers and markets providing enormous amounts of surplus food to struggling communities and families, and many farmers markets offer vouchers that provide twice the value for those in need. All of you, we have to wrap it up here. We could have talked a lot more, but Robert, it was really good to be with you today. Thank you for being on the air.
Thank you, Laura. Likewise.
That's Rob Johnson, Policy Director for the New Hampshire Farm Bureau Federation, owner of Johnson Bros Farm in Pittsfield. Andre, thank you very much. We'll talk to you again.
Thank you so much. It was a lot of fun.
That's Andre Cantelmo, co-owner of Heron Palm Farm in Southampton, president of the New Hampshire Vegetable and Berry Growers Association, and a co-founder of Three River Farmers Alliance. Kate, also good to talk to you, too. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Kate Osgood, owner of Birch Rise Farm in Sanborntown, where she raises pigs, turkeys, chickens. Kate also serves on the Belknap County Farm Bureau Board, and she works with UNH Cooperative Extension in her county. Well, today's show was produced by our senior producer, Ellen Grimm. And today we need to say thanks and goodbye and very best wishes to Ellen. After 10 years, she is moving on from the exchange. We'll miss her legendary work ethic, news smarts, incredible kindness and compassion for everyone. Thank you so, so much, Ellen, from all of us. You're listening to The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Stitcher for NHPR Exchange.